All right, so here's where we were yesterday. I told you Aquinas' ethical theory has as its heart relationship. The primary relationship is between God and a human person, but also that is a shareable relationship, and that relationship is a relationship of love. Aquinas thinks you can distinguish between big goods and little goods, and here's how you can distinguish between them. Big goods don't diminish when you distribute them. So if I distribute pizza, my pizza diminishes as I hand it out. I have less and less pizza in my box, the more pizza I give to you. But knowledge is not like that, so I can distribute what I know to you, and I don't get stupider when I do so. That makes knowledge a big good and pizza a little good. The biggest good of all is love in union with God, and therefore that is also the most shareable good. So that's the heart of the human moral life, that's the heart of human excellence. A second personal relationship with God, shareable with all other human beings too. And here's the interesting thing. Aquinas has an account of love which is, in my view, brilliant. I'm not saying he invented it, but he has a nice, clear way of presenting it. And it's better than any other account of love I know, certainly better than any account on offer in the contemporary philosophical literature today. What makes Aquinas' account so powerful, so explanatory, is that it has love as a systems-level feature. Love is a feature that emerges from the interaction of two mutually governing desires. One, a desire for the good of the beloved, and two, a desire for union with the beloved. If you think about that a little bit, you'll see it can handle all kinds of cases, all kinds of problems. It yields a really rich and powerful understanding of the nature of forgiveness, for example. Anyway, it's a great account of love, in my view. And in the ethical theory of Aquinas, all virtues are one or another kind of disposition to love, and all the vices are one or another way of failing to love. So here's the idea. Without love, Aquinas thinks there can be no good in a moral person, no moral good in a person, but with love, all the other virtues are present too. Because you remember I told you yesterday, Aquinas holds the unity of the virtues thesis. If you have love, you have all the virtues. And if you don't have love, you don't have any of them. That's the idea. Now, a deadly sin is a sin that will kill your soul and keep you from union with God in heaven. And that's because it destroys a relationship of love between you and God. For that same reason, it also destroys love between human persons. Now, what I want to tell you is, what's at issue here is a union of love. And that means that in a certain sense, what I'm about to do isn't quite right. I'm about to give you a list. But the list suggests that if you just keep this list by you, make sure you don't have any of the sins on this list, you're good to go. And that's actually not true, because the issue is love. And humans are so complicated and so ingenious that there's simply no list you can give them that won't allow them to be evil while keeping all the things on the list, or avoiding all the things on the list. When my kids were very tiny, before my daughter was born and we just had two boys, we had a list of rules that we taped onto the microwave. And it was called Rules for Boys. And it went like this. No boy may hit another boy. No boy may stand outside the door of another boy's room when that boy is trying to nap and sing loudly. And so on, you know. But what was perfectly clear was, no matter how long that list was going to go, there was no way to make the list long enough to prevent one boy from being malicious to the other boy. That's what human beings are. So I'm going to give you a list, the standard list of the seven deadly sins. But I want you to understand that the system is not a list-keeping system. It's not the case that if you print this list, keep it, watch out for these things in yourself, then you got a guaranteed place in heaven because humans are so ingenious, they can fail to love even while they keep all the things on the list. The issue is love. So this is a list which is a rule of thumb. It's helpful, but it's not all there is. So here's our list. Oh wait, I want to tell you one more thing before I get to the list. The other thing you have to remember is what a mortal sin is. It's a sin that kills love between you and God. So that's another way in which the list is misleading, because you can do something on the list and it can still not count as a mortal sin. Now, how could that possibly be? Because even while you're in the midst of it, you're loathing yourself for this, you're wishing that God would give you the strength not to do this, you're hanging on to God. Let me put it to you this way. Who is the villain of the Christian tradition? It's Judas, right? Right? He's the ultimate bad guy. He betrayed Christ to his death. Okay, it doesn't get any worse than that. What could you do that's worse than that? Who's the hero of the Christian story? On which rock is the church founded? Well, that would be Peter, right? And what did Peter do? He betrayed Christ in his hour of need, right? So now we have the villain and the hero, and they've got the exact same sin. And now the question arises, okay, wait, what's the difference? What's the difference between them? And you might think to yourself, it's easy. Peter repented, Judas did not. But there you would be wrong, because we have it on biblical authority that Judas repented. So now we have the worst guy and the best guy. They share the same sin, and they share repentance. Now what's the difference? Here's the difference. Each of them had a love for Christ, and each of them had a love for something antithetical to Christ, and each of them acted on the love antithetical to Christ, and each of them repented doing so. So now in each of them we have a divided, an internally divided human being, part on God's side, part opposed to God's side. When Peter first sees Christ after the resurrection, they first meet. I mean, the last thing that Peter has before Christ dies is Christ looking at him. So Peter can see himself in Christ's eyes and see what a horrible thing he did to betray his beloved in that way. And the story says Peter went out and wept bitterly, and I'll bet you he did. But that's the last thing, and then Christ dies. The first meeting of them, when Christ and Peter come back together, here's how I would have written that scene. If I'd been allowed to write the scene, I would have written it like this. I would have had Christ say, Peter, okay, what you did was really horrible, it was really bad, but I just hope you do know I love you anyway. I've always loved you. In fact, God is love. There's no way I don't love you. I've always loved you, so I do hope you remember that. That's how I would have written it, and that's not how it goes at all. My way of writing it would have been really stupid. Here's how it goes. Christ does not say to Peter, I love you. Christ says to Peter, do you love me? And now if I'd been writing the next part of the story, this is how I would have written it. I would have said, well, I want to love you. I do. I really do. I mean, I don't know if I'm allowed to say that I love you after what I did. I mean, I don't know if that would be an appropriate thing for a person like me to say, but I want to love you. Well, actually, maybe even that's giving myself too much. Maybe the best I could say is I want to love you. I mean, or even maybe that wouldn't be quite right. That's the kind of neurotic way that I go. And what does Peter say? Yes. Yes, I love you. That's the difference between a mortal and a venial sin. It's not whether or not you betray Christ. It's whether when you betray Christ, you identify with the part of yourself that did the betrayal, and you say, this is the true me, and I need to throw myself away because I am a betrayer. I'm going to throw myself away. That's what Judas did. He identified with a fragmented part of himself that was against Christ and committed suicide. Threw himself away as broken beyond repair. And Peter, in the face of his own evil, hung on and was willing to say to Christ, I love you. The love, which is the one essential ingredient for salvation and for human excellence, that can persist even in the failure of something so evil, so vile, as a betrayal of Christ, provided you will just hang on, as long as you hang on and don't break the connection, branch to vine, whatever it was you did, you and Christ together can get past. So that's the thing to remember about the deadly sins. They are deadly when they break love, but it doesn't follow that you can't be guilty of one of these and still hang on so that love is not broken. So that's what I hope you understand. Okay, with that background, here's our list. Now, it is really important to memorize some stuff. Even in our day of smartphones and internet and so on, it's really important to memorize some stuff. And the old lore handed on in the Catholic intellectual tradition is really good to memorize. So I've given you a helping hand to remember this list, Pewsoggle. See? Now you never ever have to forget them again. It's really easy, Pewsoggle. There's the list, pride, P, envy, E, wrath, W, sloth, S, avarice, A, G, gluttony, L, lust, Pewsoggle. And they go in order from the worst to the least. Pride is the worst, and you'll be surprised in this culture to discover lust is the least. And they're rank ordered on the basis of love. So lust is the least because human beings are made in the image of God. So if you prefer your connection to another human being over your connection to God in obedience, at least what you prefer to God is an image of God. That's something. You know, if your problem is gluttony, what you're preferring to God is the pleasure of eating, that's worse. But of course, in the pleasure of eating, you're still privileging something about the nature God gave you. So you're still connected to God through this nature. If you get all the way up to pride, there's really nothing besides your own small self that you're interested in or caring for, and that's the worst of all. So that's how the sins go. The principle of ordering is the degree to which the sin separates you from the love of God. That's it. So we're going to start with these sins. We're going to work from the worst to the least. And here's pride. Pride has four species. And they go like this. The first species of pride is thinking you have an excellence you don't have. Now, I am sorely tempted here, but I'm going to avoid any mention whatsoever of the President of the United States. But consider children. Children manifest this pride. I'm the best basketball player in the world. Well, you know, maybe on the block for this game or something. So thinking you have an excellence you don't have is a very childish kind of pride. So that's the first kind. Then there's thinking you have an excellence you do have, but thinking you got it for yourself. So I have a philosopher buddy who, truth to tell, has a kid who made it big in Hollywood. It's really true. His kid says stuff like, I'm going to do lunch with Denzel Washington. And my philosopher buddy friend has told me with sadness that he's heard his kid say, everything I got for myself. And I think with laughter in my heart, kid, I was there. I was there when you were born. I was there when you were little. This is ridiculous. You know, your parents fed you, clothed you, nurtured you. They drove you halfway around a big city all the time in order to get you to your fancy lessons. They paid more than they could afford to put you in the best schools, and so on. Not to mention the fact that you were born into a country at peace. You lived in a time of relative prosperity. You didn't have to go to some factory and work as a four-year-old because you didn't live in that kind of poverty, and so on. I think myself, kid, everything you got was gift. You didn't get it for yourself. So that's the second kind of pride. And here's the third kind of pride. They get worse as you go along. Here's the third kind of pride. It's thinking you have an excellence you do have, and thinking you got it from God. You didn't get it from yourself. But thinking that God gave it to you and not to him, because God knew you would make good use of it, unlike this dumb schmuck who would just have wasted it. So that's the third kind of pride. And then there's the fourth kind of pride. This is the pride of the prig. Or this is the pride of the Pharisee in the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. So what does the Pharisee say in the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector? He says, thank you, God, that I am not like other men. So he's thanking God for the excellences he has, and he really has them. He says, I fast twice a week, I tithe mint and cumin. Those are excellences, that's good. So he's got excellences, not the first kind of pride. He's thanking God for giving them to him, but what's the matter with our Pharisee? Thank you, God, that I am not like other men, not like this tax collector here. So here's what we know about our Pharisee. He thinks he has an excellence he does have. He thinks God gave it to him because God is good. And here's the problem. He's glad that other people don't have these excellences, and he hopes they don't get them because it is a source of pleasure for him, builds him up to be able to look down on other people. That's the worst kind of pride. Here's the really interesting thing about these four species of pride. They give us a very lovely account of humility. Humility is the opposite of pride. So humility is the opposite of these four kinds of pride. And what is that? It's thinking that everything you've got is gift, and all of it is given to you for the sake of your giving it back by sharing it with others. So Dante, the great poet Dante, when he comes into, he puts himself in his poem. So Dante the Traveler is in the poem of Dante the Poet. Dante the Traveler comes into limbo and he sees the great poets of antiquity. Homer is there, Virgil is there. And Dante says, they made me one of their company. Now why doesn't that immediately make him guilty of the mortal sin of pride and send him plummeting down in hell to the bottom? Why not? Because he's right. Because being a great poet is an excellence he does have, and he accepts it as a gift from God. So recognizing your excellences, the ones you really have, is perfectly compatible with humility, provided that you understand they are gifts to you and gifts given to you in order to be shared with others. That's the idea about pride. Okay, and then there's envy. Here's what envy is. It's unreasonable sorrow at another's good. Unreasonable sorrow. So pick your favorite bad guys in history. Take the Nazis, they're everybody's favorite bad guys. If the Nazis had won a battle and you'd been sorrowful over there winning that battle, that wouldn't have been envy. That would just have been perfectly compatible with reason and goodness, because being sorrowful at their winning a battle is not unreasonable. It is a good thing that they lose, their battle, a bad thing that they win. And envy is unreasonable sorrow over another's good. So back up a minute. See that? See love? The heart of the ethical life is love. And what does love want? The good of the beloved. Well, who's your beloved? Gosh, remember the parable of the Good Samaritan and the question, who's my neighbor? It's everybody. Your beloved is everybody. In one way or another, your beloved is everybody. You have to want the good for everybody. If there's somebody who's good you don't want, you're missing in love. That's the idea. So that's why envy is a sin, because it's unreasonable sorrow over somebody else is good. Now, here's the thing I have to tell you, can't be helped. The deadly sins have daughters. If the world had been left up to me to govern entirely, the deadly sins would have had sons. But as it is, they have daughters. So we're going to look at the daughters of the deadly sins as they go along. And the daughters are not species exactly. This is not a genus-species relation. It's more nearly like this. It's what envy will flow out into in certain circumstances. Be an envious person, be in the right circumstances, and it's likely you're going to do one of these things. That's the idea. So here are the daughters of envy. The first daughter is telling tales. Would you happen to remember what the more common word for this is? Yeah, it's gossip. This is gossip. When you gossip, You tell something bad about another person to some third party, and why do you do it? For the pleasure of putting that person down so you can feel better about yourself. So you are having unreasonable sorrow over somebody's good. So you say, you know, I just heard we should really pray about him. I just heard he's having an affair with the secretary. We should really pray for him. It's got a thin disguise, this envy, but it's not very much of a disguise. That's gossip. And it's a violation of love because love desires the good for its neighbor. I had someone who came to see me one time and said, I smell breath on Father So-and-so's. I smell whiskey on Father So-and-so's breath in the morning. Don't you think we should tell his superior about this? And I thought, well, no, actually I don't. You know, I don't. There's another way to handle it besides telling stories about him to people in charge of him. So that's the first daughter of envy. And here's the second daughter. It's detraction. That's when you do the gossip thing, but you do it to the newspapers. You do it in public. You do it in your tweets, for example. So you call and question somebody else's integrity or somebody else's faithfulness or somebody else's moral character, but you do it in a very public way, not one-on-one in a whisper, but publicly. That's detraction. And then here are the two last ones, joy at our neighbor's misfortune and grief at our neighbor's prosperity. Some wit, I forgot who it was, said, every time my colleague publishes a book, I die a little. So that's grief at our neighbor's prosperity. See, and that's envy too. And all these things kill your relationship with God. And why? They do, because these are ways of not loving your neighbor, not loving one of God's children. And insofar as you don't love one of his children, don't wish good for one of his children, you don't wish good for him. And why is this so? Because he loves his children. And it's a failure of good for God if one of his children doesn't get something good. So that's how that works. And then there's wrath. Now wrath is to be distinguished from anger or righteous indignation. The terminology is fluid here. Scriptural texts, especially in the King James Version, they talk about the wrath of God. The tradition recognizes a distinction between anger, which is really good or even obligatory, and wrath, which is bad. And the difference is between the reasonable desire to punish and the unreasonable desire to punish. So if my students all decide to take a day off and they simply don't show up for my class, and I think, boy, and I worked so hard to prepare that class, those jerks, I think I'll just have to get an Uzi and shoot them all. We now have an unreasonable desire to punish. Whatever the fault is, it doesn't manifest, it doesn't merit death by machine gun fire. So that's the difference between wrath on the one hand and anger on the other. There are cases where if you're not angry, there's something wrong with you too. So you see some person abuse a child in the grocery store, and you think to yourself, huh, look at that, really hurting that child. Wonder how much they're selling apples for today. And then there's something morally wrong with you. You need to be angry. It'd be unreasonable not to be angry. Milton says the two most obvious manifestations of the human capacity for reason are anger and laughter. And you can see why, because in each case you notice a discrepancy between what is and what ought to be. And in one kind of case it makes you laugh, and in another kind of case it makes you angry. So anger is sometimes good, sometimes even morally obligatory, but we're talking about wrath, an unreasonable desire to punish another person. And it has three species: choleric wrath, sullen wrath, and rancorous wrath. And it's good to see the difference. So I have somebody very dear to me who struggles with choleric wrath. Cross him in the wrong sort of way, hit him on the wrong part of the psyche, and there will be a thunderstorm that is really memorable. Chairs flying across the room, obscenities, profanities spewing out everywhere. My friend understands this is bad and is working on it, but you know, there it is, and those who find him dear and are around him take care not to trip those wires. You don't really want to watch that kind of storm. That's choleric wrath. But then there's sullen wrath. It's a different kind. That kind of wrath goes like this. What's the matter, honey? Did I do anything to upset you? No. Well, something's the matter. What is it? Nothing. And this nothing and its silence can go on for days. There was a cartoon on the door of a psychologist in a university where I visited one time, and the cartoon was like this. There was one dinosaur sitting in an easy chair, looking very female, and one dinosaur standing around uneasily, looking very male. And the male dinosaur was saying to the female dinosaur, was it something I said?
No.
Was it something I did? No. Was it something I omitted to say? No. Was it something I said when I omitted to say something that I really should have said? Oh, I thought that might have been it. And now we're talking about sullen wrath. And this sullen wrath can be not directed at a particular person, but it can be directed against the world at large. Dante has a place where there are sullen people, and in hell, and he hears the punishment for the sullen. So all Dante's punishments show you the nature of the sin. The punishment for the sullen in Dante's Inferno is this: they lie on their backs at the bottom of a very muddy swamp, and they sing a little song under the mud. And the song they sing comes kind of gurgly, because when they sing, they open their mouths and then all the mud rushes in. So it's a kind of a gurgly song. And they sing, "We were sad in the beautiful light of God's world." That's sullen wrath. And then there's rancorous wrath. So I'm not any good at popular culture, but did you guys ever see a movie called Princess Bride? Do you know this movie? What's the name of the guy who's trying to kill the fellow who killed his dad? Yeah, my name is Watsit Montoya. You killed my father, prepare to die. In the movie, the guy has been saying that speech for years, for decades. He isn't particularly choleric, he isn't sullen, he's cheerful. He's just cheerfully going on, putting everything in his life at the service of finding the guy who killed his father and getting revenge. That's rancorous wrath, when all of life is ordered in a cheerful, reasonable, self-disciplined kind of way to getting the other guy and grinding him down. That's rancorous wrath. And all of those are deadly sin, because all of them are a way of insisting on finding the bad for your neighbor and not the good for him. That's why. And wrath has daughters too. You should know, by the way, that this list of sins is really old. So it gets its canonical formulation with Gregory the Great. Aquinas inherits it from Gregory. But we find it much earlier. We find it in Cassian, for example. It doesn't have exactly the same form in Cassian, but pretty close. So it's a very, very old list. And you know what's really funny about this list is it changes at the time of the Protestant Reformation in England. And the way it changes is really funny as an indication of what separated Catholics and Protestants in that early age. Sloth, which is what we're coming to next. Sloth is a sin of, I can't, I just can't, it's too hard. And in the Protestant Reformation, in the Puritan times in England, sloth changes into idleness or laziness, so that it's the opposite not of charity, it's the opposite of industry and hard work. And it becomes the first of all the sins, and lust, which is the least of the sins On the Thomistic list, lust moves up the list, so it becomes third in badness. So lust gains in badness with those Puritans, and the first of the sins becomes laziness. So that's something about the order of the list. Anyway, here's our daughters of wrath. There's indignation. Indignation is when you chew in your mind at the unworthiness of another person. She thinks she's so cool. She thinks she's so pretty. She's continually making other people feel they're not pretty, but she's not all that pretty. I mean, I see wrinkles on her cheek. She's getting older by the day. That's indignation. And then swelling of the mind is thinking how to get them. I could actually give her, I could give her as a present, this yellow handbag. She never realized that when she carries that yellow handbag, it just brings out the yellow in her complexion. She'd look off. That's swelling of the mind. How to get the other guy. And then if you have disorderly speech, then you've got clamor. You're sitting in the department meeting and somebody says about the provost, he's a criminal, he's a criminal. But of course, you know, that would be figurative speech at best. Didn't mean that there's no criminal accusation against this man, no criminal conviction. Okay, so that's clamor. Contumely is a particularly nasty variation on wrath. Contumely is a matter of making the other guy feel humiliated and intending to do it. So one time when I was a graduate student, there was a graduate student who was prematurely middle-aged, a little paunchy, a little balding, but he thought of himself as a particularly cool dude, kind of the prince in that crop of graduate students. And there was a faculty person with a cruel wit who didn't like him for his pompousness and pretension. And the discussion in the group, in the philosophy group, was about personal identity, and our prematurely aging prince of graduate students said pompously, I just cannot imagine waking up in the body of an Italian housewife. To which the faculty member said quietly, well, I can't imagine it either. I'm hoping you don't need me to explain the joke because I don't want to, but it's a cruel and mean joke. And that's an example of contumely. I can see from your faces you don't get the joke. You'll figure it out later, it's okay. And then there's blasphemy, and then there's quarreling. I think you can understand what these are. Blasphemy are bad words about God, putting God down, and quarreling is when you actually take this wrath and turn it into some sort of official division from another person in a quarrel. So that's the daughters of wrath. And then there's sloth. So sloth is an oppressive sorrow that disparages the good things God has given us and neglects to do good out of weariness. It's opposed to love of God's goodness, and it's a refusal of joy. So, I once knew a young man who said, all I want is a little house, a little job, a little wife. Now, you know, that's not much of an aspiration. It's a sense of thinking, well, there's not much to me, there's not much in life, I don't need to try for anything, I couldn't get anywhere if I tried, what's the point? This is the sin that goes sort of like this. Everybody hates me, nobody loves me, and I'm having a bad hair day. I might as well go into the backyard and eat worms. It's not laziness, it's more nearly like a low-level depression, a non-clinical depression. And what's lovely about this medieval system, in my view, is it labels it a sin. See, what we do when we see somebody in that connection is we say, oh, you aren't having a bad hair day. You look so nice. I love your hair like that. It really looks good on you. And now what we know is this never works. You know, it never works. It just encourages the person who's having the problem to say, no, it doesn't look nice. You're just saying that to make me feel better. And that's true. You are. So it's an inefficacious way of comforting a person who's stuck with this problem. And the medieval system is a really very funny system. It hits the depressed person upside the head and it says, hey, guess what, that's a sin. You're not allowed to talk like that about any of God's creatures, not yourself either. You are of infinite value, precious, lovely, beloved of the Lord. You can't talk like that about anybody, but especially not yourself. And I'm thinking, well, I don't know, it's a strategy to help somebody in a non-clinical depression. Maybe that has its points. But in any event, the idea is, when you sit down on the road of your life, refuse to stand up and walk on the journey to the Lord, sit there in the middle of the road and say, I can't, it's too hard, it's impossible, can't be done. What you have is sloth. That's it. Your job is to keep walking, and God will give the grace. That's the idea. And here's the daughters of sloth. Sloth, which is non-clinical, I can't, non-clinical sadness, it will blossom not into clinical despair, if it keeps going, it will blossom, I mean, not into clinical depression, but it blossoms into despair if it keeps going. That's its full outcome. So here's how that goes. Here's how the progress goes. First, there's sluggishness with regard to the commandments. Here's a commandment, honor your father and your mother, and you think to yourself, yeah, did they ever see the pair I got stuck with? I don't think so. Nobody, but nobody, could honor these. So I don't know what to do, but it's just hopeless in my case, can't be done, whatever. Now we have sluggishness with regard to the commandments. The commandment says, honor your father and your mother, doesn't happen to mention on what conditions or how nice they have to be before the commandment comes into effect. Then there's wandering of the mind after unlawful things. Kind of day of hand, I just need a scotch. Actually, three of them. And now what we have is an attempt to help with what you feel is too much for you by looking not for the Lord and His grace or for human company or something that is lawful, but looking for help in something that's unlawful. Then we have faint-heartedness. Oh, I can't, it's too much. One time when my little granddaughter was 4 years old, she was coming down the stairs at my house and she was carrying both arms full of stuffed animals. This child had a kind of a, you know, an overabundance of children. So she had millions of stuffed animals in her arms, and as she came down the stairs, she dropped them. And then there was a wail that you could have heard in the neighboring city. And I said, oh, good heavens, what's the matter? And she said, I dropped my Snugglies. And I said, well, pick them up. I can't, I can't. That's faint-heartedness. Sure you can, just bend down, pick up the first one, then the second one, then the third one, then you got them. Eventually you'll get them. But faint-heartedness is, I can't. Then there's spite, where you just, the other guy gets something good. You didn't particularly want it for yourself, but you just wish the other guy didn't have it. Just because you feel better, the other guy doesn't have something good, even if you don't want that good. Makes you feel better about what you can't, about the good you can't get. Then there's malice, when you actively try to make sure the other guy doesn't get something good. And then there's despair, where you just give up on goodness entirely. On your good, on anybody's good, just give up. So that's sloth, and here's avarice. Avarice is an unreasonable desire for acquisition. Now, in its canonical form, it can show up in either of two ways. Either you can be a super stingy person. You see the person begging at the street corner and you say, oh, I never give to beggars. Or you get an appeal from UNICEF and you say, well, I don't know that they're a really responsible organization. I give only to responsible organizations. And you never give to any organizations because you don't know about any of them whether they're responsible. So that's one kind of avarice when you're stingy. Another kind of avarice is when you're a spendthrift. You just buy and buy and buy and buy, and your friends say, she has a shopping problem. That's another form of avarice. But basically, avarice is the counting sin. It does not have to be about property or money. It can be about anything. There are people who count their publications obsessively, who keep a CV handy, and at the top list the number of their publications. They comfort themselves by counting. The desire to comfort yourself by counting, by adding stuff onto yourself, is very deep-seated in us. So one time, I was left in charge of two of my grandchildren, two tiny little ones. We had to get the girl to school, but her little brother was completely uncooperative. We couldn't get out the door, it was really cold, and the little guy wouldn't put his shoes on. And, you know, in the world as it is, the parents of my grandchildren do not allow me to hit them. So I was stuck without a resource for getting the shoes on that child to get the little girl out the door to get her to school on time. I was really up against it. And then I had a great idea. I grabbed a piece of paper and I said to the little malefactor, Johnny, if you don't get those shoes on, you're going to lose 50 points. Now you have to understand that I just invented the point system. These points were not, you know, an established thing in his world. He had no idea what the points were connected to, and actually they weren't connected to anything. He didn't get ice cream if he, you know, had minimum number of points, or lose ice cream if he had too many points. Nothing. I just made it up. So I took my pen and my pad. I said, if you don't get those shoes, I'm losing 50 points. And he said, Nana, you wouldn't. And I said, yes, I would. Shoes got on so fast. That's avarice. You feel better if you get points. It doesn't matter what they are. Just points. Give me points. That's the counting sin. Doesn't matter too much what you count, but you comfort yourself by counting, and that's not the right way to comfort yourself. And avarice has got daughters too. Here they are. Insensibility to mercy. That's the desire to keep. You don't want to lose any points, you're going to keep them. So somebody is in need, this person needs help being taken to the hospital, you were going to go out to dinner, and you think, can't somebody else take them to the hospital? I mean, why does it have to be me? That's insensibility and mercy. Then there's restlessness. I need to go shopping again. I think I need another vase. You can always use another vase, can't you? Or another pair of shoes. There was once a Yoplait commercial that went like this. Two women talking about this yogurt. One of them said, this is so good. The other one said, it's better than good. The other one said, yeah, it's shoe shopping good. That's avarice. That's where you feel better if you just got another pair of shoes. So that's restlessness. And then 3 through 7 on this list are all the lengths to which a person will go to keep what he's got or get some more. Perjury, fraud, violence, and treachery. So that's the daughters of avarice. And then there's gluttony. Gluttony comes in these species. You're going to like these. So gluttony is a deadly sin too. Now we don't usually like to think about this, because in our culture, really and truly, it would be hard to find somebody who doesn't have some participation in this sin. So consider that first one, forestalling the hour of need. Do you know what we call that in our culture? Snacking. Snacking. The idea here is something like this. Look, you're commanded to love your neighbor as yourself, but then included in this command is the love of yourself. And you come in two components, a bodily component and a psychological component, or as we used to say before, people worried about the word, body and soul, but a psychological component and a bodily component, and to love yourself is to wish good for yourself. Now, if you wish good for yourself, and you eat in wrong kinds of ways, you impair your own health or your own attractiveness or all of the above. And so part of what you are commanded under the command of love is taking care of yourself. So if you have a sugar addiction and you're continually piling in the sweets, what do we know? You're setting yourself up for type 2 diabetes, you're setting yourself up for circulatory problems, and so on. But then you're not loving yourself because you're not wishing good to yourself. So gluttony is on the list of sins, and that is hard for us because we figure if you eat healthy, you're wonderful, but if you don't eat healthy, you're one of us. None of us is eating healthy either, and we really sort of wish you wouldn't eat healthy either because it shows us up. I'm just saying, it's on the list. So here it is, forestalling the hour of need, seeking costly meats. The only coffee I can drink is Starbucks. In fact, not even really Starbucks. I need that, you know, $8 a cup stuff. That's the only coffee that works for me. That's the seeking costly meats part. Requiring dainty cooking. Okay, so this is one for me. I am the last of the very great picky eaters, and I have a terrible, terrible time eating flesh. And I've got this much by way of fish that I can tolerate, and then I can really only tolerate it in case I cook it, because I know how to cook salmon in the right way and nobody else does. Well, okay, there you go. Requiring dainty cooking. You make the salmon, I'm not eating it. That's how that works. Okay. Taking too much. That's for absolutely every one of us without exception. And then there's having the heat of an immoderate appetite. Oh, give me that whipped cream. I'm going to fall down face first in it right now and I can't wait. Sort of like that. Eat dessert first. Life is too short. Life is uncertain. That's it. And here's the daughters of gluttony, unseemly joy. That's what happens when you get a little drunk. That's what happens when you overindulge. You get a little silly and other people have to put up with you. That's not so nice. Scurrility, loquaciousness, dullness of mind. Did you ever find yourself stone cold sober talking to somebody who was drunk? And how much fun was that? Dullness of mind, loquaciousness, they can't shut up and everything they say is so stupid. So all of those there are a function of the ability of food and drink to undermine your ability to think straight or to behave in a way that we expect of civilized human beings. All of those except uncleanness. Uncleanness is what happens when, you know, you start throwing up on yourself because you're really too full or too drunk. Okay. So that's the daughters of gluttony, and then we're getting pretty close to the end here because we've got mass to go to, but lust is a matter of going for the satisfaction of sexual appetite in an unreasonable way, where what is unreasonable takes a long time to talk about and figure out. But here's the list of its daughters. Blindness of the mind. So what that means is that's also a matter of not being able to think straight. So here's an example. I was once sent on the mission of mercy to talk to a guy who was divorcing his wife because he'd fallen in love with a younger and more interesting woman. And he was explaining to himself his situation. He was explaining to me his situation. He was saying, well, you know, my wife is dowdy and overweight and kind of not very interesting, you know. But this younger woman, she's beautiful and I love her and I really want her. And we do wonderful things together. I'm so happy when I'm with her. And I don't think God wants me to be unhappy. And I'm thinking to myself a thought that goes sort of like this, wondering if this can be translated into polite English. I'm thinking a thought like this. What an idiot, I'm thinking. What an idiot. You got a God who doesn't want you to be unhappy, but he's perfectly content with your wife crying and your kids crying. Doesn't matter to this God if your wife and kids are unhappy. No, it's just your happiness that God cares about. Think, how can you fail to notice what this sounds like? That's blindness of mind. When your passion keeps you from really thinking straight, even just thinking this far, how does this sound in the mind of somebody else when they listen to you? And then there's thoughtlessness, inconstancy, rashness. So you don't need me to explain those to you, right? That's what you get when you got somebody in the grip of this kind of passion. And then we have self-love. That's what that guy was evincing. God cares about his happiness but doesn't mind about anybody else's. And that constitutes a hatred of God, because what God really is good, not your boss who is in heaven. Your partisan who is in heaven, your mafia godfather who is in heaven. God is really good, and if you're transposing him into somebody who cares about your happiness and nobody else's, then what God really is hateful to you. And then we have love of this world, and then in the end, if it gets bad enough, we have despair, because you find, after all, that what you are and what you care about simply won't fit with what God is and cares about. So that's the seven deadlies.